Ah, got it working.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, December 2nd. How am I on that? December 2nd, looks like. Yeah, today's December 2nd. The day right after Thanksgiving holiday. All right, and we're going to finish up chapter 14, which is cardiac output, blood flow, blood pressure, move into respiratory chapter today. And let's see, for the rest of this week, I'll finish up respiratory, get into renal physiology, and then we'll have a short lecture on diversification system. Look for the update of what you need to do for the diversification system for the lecture. I think there's one exam figure and some questions at the end of the chapter. All right, and so that's what you're responsible for. There's some page numbers. That one figure is very important, so we're going to go over that, but I'm also going to give that as an extra credit drawing in lab. It's a profile of various hormones during the uterine cycle and ovarian cycle, and I'll send that email out probably today or tomorrow. But there is a drawing in today's lab, which is the cardiac output statement that we looked at before. It's a nice figure that shows that cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate and what various influences are on the inotropy and chronotropy on the heart. Okay, any question on the schedule? No question on the schedule? Great. All right, so what did you guys come up with as far as blood flow? What is blood flow through the heart? Blood flow is a volume per time. It's not speed, it's not a distance per time, but it's a volume per time, like mLs per minute, something like that. What would that be for the heart? Blood flow is equal to cardiac output. And what's cardiac output equal to? I heard something that I like. Stroke volume times heart rate. Nice. All right, so let's not forget that equation. What about blood flow through a blood vessel? So I'll put a heart right here, and then I'll put blood flow through a blood vessel. What is that equal to? I have it basically on the screen for you to see. What's the force that moves blood through a vessel? Remember, for diffusion, it's concentration gradient, but for a fluid in a blood vessel, what's the driving force? It's pressure, okay? The pressure from blood will flow from high pressure to low pressure, just like molecules will diffuse from high concentration to low concentration. So blood flow through a blood vessel is going to be equal to the blood pressure, right, divided by something. Hopefully you guys in the back can see my writing. I forgot you guys are way back there. Divided by, and I think I heard it someplace, resistance. Okay, divided by resistance. And that's basically Poiseuille's law that you worked with in lab. And this resistance, there are various parameters that we build into resistance, like the length of a blood vessel, the viscosity of blood, the radius of a blood vessel. And so how does your body regulate blood flow? By changing the radius of a blood vessel, because that has a huge influence on what the resistance in that blood vessel is. Because remember, it's radius to the fourth power. So a small change in radius makes a huge change in resistance, which makes a huge change in blood flow. All right, so how would you talk about blood flow through the heart in terms of stroke volume? What's the relationship between stroke volume and blood flow through the heart? Directly related. Right, stroke volume goes up. Cardiac output goes up. Well, how do you describe the relationship with cardiac output and heart rate? Directly related. Nice. What's the relationship between blood flow in a blood vessel and blood pressure? Directly related. That's nice and easy. And what about blood flow through a blood vessel and resistance? Inversely related, right? So if resistance increases, blood flow decreases, right? So resistance is just a resistance to flow. So those are some important equations probably that you should just memorize. I don't know how to get the projections off the board, but hopefully you can see that. All right, so we're done looking at the schedule. Your last exam is on a Thursday, and it's going to cover chapters 13, 14, 16, which is what we're going to talk today about, and some of 17, and just a little bit of 20. Okay, so that's what's going to be on that last exam. on Thursday. It's not comprehensive. It just covers those chapters right there. All right, so let's look at some slides. As I turn some of these lights down, like that one I like, that one I turn off. All right, so here is basically that illustration of blood flow through a blood vessel. Right? And so you have to know what the difference in pressure is from the artery to this vein. Right? Pressure at the end of this vein is zero. Pressure at the aorta, the mean pressure is about 100 millimeters of mercury, so you subtract those two numbers, but when you subtract the zero from something, right, you still get that original number. So it's 100 millimeters of mercury is the delta pressure or the pressure difference. All right, so we also see on this illustration that the blood flow through a blood vessel is also going to equal the blood flow through, what is this thing here? I see these four square chambers. Of course, they're not square, but you know that there's an organ in your body that has four chambers, and that is your heart. All right, so blood flow, when it flows through a blood vessel, it also flows through the heart. And as a matter of fact, these things have to be equal to each other. Right? If they're not equal to each other, then blood is going to back up in the heart, or blood is going to back up in the blood vessel. And that can happen under some circumstances for a short period of time, but certainly not a long period of time. And if that happens to the heart is going to fail if it gets big, if it gets dilated. All right, so that's the other thing that we're going to work with today in just a little bit. So on this figure right here, you want to see blood flow is equal to pressure divided by resistance. And here is that same equation. Blood flow is equal to the pressure difference, right? And R to the fourth power divided by viscosity and length. This is the resistance. That's one way that we can think about resistance. So resistance is going to be down here in the denominator. So if we increase the length, we increase resistance, decreases blood flow. If we increase the radius of a blood vessel, that decreases resistance because that's down in the denominator, that will increase blood flow. So small changes in radius have huge changes in blood flow through a blood vessel. And that's how our body regulates blood flow through various parts of our body, because we can't change the length of a blood vessel. It's just going to stay the same. Can't change the viscosity of blood. That's going to stay the same, a constant. Okay, on this illustration, we got a plot of blood pressure versus what that blood pressure is in different locations, in different blood vessels, and even the left ventricle. And of course, you can see that during diastole, pressure in a ventricle is zero, and then at systole, it shoots up to 120 millimeters of mercury, and then during diastole, goes back down to zero. So that pressure difference, right, is 120 millimeters of mercury. When the heart contracts, it pumps a bunch of blood into the aorta, and the pressure in the aorta never goes to zero, thank goodness, because we'd probably pass out, right? It just goes to about 80 millimeters of mercury. That's the end diastolic pressure, and it only goes to 120. That's the systolic pressure. So when we measure pressure in somebody, we get two numbers, right? The systolic and diastolic blood pressures. That's what we see right here. Then as blood flows into smaller arteries, what happens to the pressure? What can you see happening to the pressure? It starts to decrease, right? And even arterioles. Here are some arterioles right here. Blood pressure decreases a lot. And in capillaries, there's some decrease in pressure, and in veins, there's a little bit of decrease in pressure, but the biggest decrease is in small arteries and arterioles. And the reason why there is a decrease in pressure is because these are the high-resistance blood vessels. So any kind of pathway that's high-resistance, that's going to eat up a lot of energy, right? And that energy is the difference in pressure. So the pressure energy will be dissipated going through that resistance. So, what blood vessel has the lowest blood pressure when we look at this graph right here? So you need to analyze this graph. What blood vessel has the lowest blood pressure? Large veins even, right? Large veins? I guess that makes sense. What vessels have the highest pressure? Arteries. So yeah, so what does that mean? That means blood flows from large arteries into large veins, right? Because blood flow will go according to the difference in pressure. Right. But look at this, the left ventricle, there's a pressure of zero. Large arteries, it's 120 over 80, Right? We said that blood always flows from high pressure to low pressure, but why does blood not flow from a large artery back into the ventricle during diastole? Because the pressure is forcing it to go that way. How come it doesn't go that way? Why doesn't it go back into the heart? And you all know this, but I think you've had too much turkey. Because there is a valve. Yeah, there's a valve. And for the systemic circulation, you should know the name of that valve. Because it's the aorta, right? For the systemic circulation, the name of that valve is the aortic semilunar valve. Right? Prevents the retrograde flow of blood. Okay. But let's take a look at this. We have a couple graphs over here. We have the cross-sectional area. If we measure just the area cross-section of a blood vessel and plot it out for various blood vessels, we see that even though the aorta is a large vessel, has a large cross-sectional area, you don't need a microscope to see it, right? Maybe it's about as big as the surface of a quarter or something like that, right? It still is relatively small compared to if we add up the surface area for all the arteries, right? And even more so if we add up all the surface area, cross-sectional area for arterioles. And because we have so many arterioles, right? We have millions of arterioles. So if we add all those together, it's greater than if we just get the cross-sectional area for the aorta. And if we look at this plot, you can tell me what type of blood vessel has the greatest cross-sectional area? The capillary, right here. Right? Well, what does that mean? Because capillaries have the largest cross-sectional, right? If we add all of these cross-sectional areas together instead of millions, now we have millions and millions of capillaries, right? That's the largest cross-sectional area. That means that if the blood flows into a capillary, it's got to equal the amount of blood that's flowing through this vein, right? It's got to flow through this capillary. That means that the velocity has to decrease, right? If the blood flow in and out is equal, the velocity decreases inside this capillary. So if we look at this bottom graph, centimeters per second, what is that a measure of? Centimeters per second. Yeah, is that a flow or a velocity? And I heard velocity, right? This is what you see on the speedometer of your car, miles per hour, right here. But here is centimeters per second. That makes more sense in our body. So this is like a speedometer of blood. And where is blood the slowest? And capillaries right here, because it has the largest cross-sectional area. Well, is that a good thing? Do you think that's fortuitous, that blood flow through a capillary is the slowest compared to the aorta and large veins? Why is that a good thing? That blood takes a long time to get through a capillary? And because the purpose of a capillary is for exchange, right? So if blood went zipping through a capillary, that would reduce the amount of time that blood was there for exchange. So since blood flows down, because the cross-sectional area is huge, that allows for more exchange. Blood is in a capillary relatively long period of time. All right, so you can answer these questions right here. Okay. Maybe this is where we ended last time, talking about blood pressure. All right, well, we all know that the heart contracts, and when it contracts, it imparts pressure to blood. Right, so blood will flow from the heart through a circulation and back to an atrium because the pressure is lowest in the atrium. But let's consider blood pressure. Arterioles play a big role in where blood goes in the body. We don't have enough blood in our body to go everywhere at one time. So your body has to pick where it goes. When you're exercising, guess where blood goes? Yeah, to muscle, because muscle needs oxygen, right? Need to get rid of that lactic acid, needs glucose, needs nutrients, all right? And so when you're exercising, there's not enough blood to go to your digestive tract because blood is going to muscles, all right? And after a meal, is that a good time to, say, go and run a marathon? No, because, right, after a meal, a lot of blood is going to be going to your digestive tract, and if you're exercising, blood will want to go to muscles. There's not enough blood to go to both places, so both will be impaired when that happens. When you have impaired blood flow to a muscle, when it is exercising like that, it's going to misbehave and maybe it's going to go into spasm. It's going to contract all by itself, even though it's a skeletal muscle. So you'll get a muscle cramp when that happens. And that's why your mother told you when you were really young, what could you not do right after lunch? You can't go swimming, right? Because if you go swimming right after lunch, you're going to exercise those muscles. They don't have enough blood flow. They're going to cramp, going to spasm. And if you get a nice spasm in your abdominal wall, maybe rectus abdominis, you won't be able to hold your head above water. And then what happens to you? Well, yeah, you're drowning unless somebody's there to pick you up out of the pool, right? Okay, so how does your body determine where blood goes through? Well, it's by adjusting the diameter or the radius of a blood vessel. So here we have kind of a fancy tube, and we're going to be pouring that fluid, this red fluid, into this big diameter tube, and we're going to keep it at this level, right? It's not going to go up or going to go down. So the height of this fluid in the tube is going to determine the pressure. If we fill the tube up more, then the pressure is going to go up. If we let the fluid level go down, the pressure is going to go down. We're going to keep the pressure constant, so the level will be at just one height in this tube. All right, so we're going to pour fluid in here, and it's going to flow out of this large diameter, and it's going to flow through this horizontal pipe, and it can even enter these vertical pipes, right? And so how can we adjust the flow through these vertical pipes? And that is by adjusting the radius or the diameter of this blood vessel, right? That is leading to these vertical pipes. So here we have a constriction. All right, so we're decreasing the radius of this blood vessel right here. What happens to resistance just in this one location? It increases a little bit or a lot? A lot, because of Poiseuille's law, right? Radius to the fourth power. So here it becomes a large resistance. That's going to impede flow to this vertical pipe, so there's going to be a decreased pressure. Right, and that means there's going to be an increased pressure before that resistance, so the level in these two vertical pipes is going to increase, right? Because there's high pressure. Now let's do another thought experiment. Let's take this constriction away. Let's take this resistance away. So now blood can flow through here. What's going to happen to the level of blood in this third vertical pipe if we take this resistance away? Okay. You know it's going to go up. Because this resistance goes away, you get more blood flow through here that's going to increase the pressure, so the level in this tube is going to increase. But guess what's going to happen to the level in these two? It's going to decrease. Okay? So by adjusting the constriction or vasoconstriction in arterioles, right, or even precapillary sphincters, right, our autonomic nervous system, if it's an extrinsic control, can regulate where blood flow goes, right? Either before this resistance or when the resistance goes away to downstream capillaries. All right, so it's controlled by the aperture, the diameter of arterioles. So that's where most of the resistance is. So if we go back a couple slides, right, most of the resistance is in arterioles, and that's where we see the biggest pressure drop. The biggest pressure drop is going to be where? Across this constriction. This is where we're going to see the biggest pressure drop. So from here to here, we're not going to see much drop in pressure, right? And from here to here, we're not going to see much drop in pressure, but we'll see a big drop in pressure on either side of this constriction. That's where the energy is going to be lost. Okay. Blood pressure. Capillary blood pressure is low, okay, because of the large cross-sectional area. So what do we have right here? Pressure versus various arteries. You know, we've looked at this previously, and I asked you what vessel or what tube in your body has the lowest pressure? Veins, large veins, right? So that just ensures that blood flows from arteries to veins. Sometimes when I ask that question, as a matter of fact, a lot of times when I ask that question, what vessel has the lowest pressure, students really like to say capillary. But if capillaries have the lowest pressure, where's all the blood going to go? It's going to flow into a capillary and not get back to the heart. Right? So the noteworthy thing about capillaries, it's not the pressure that's the lowest, it's what? The speed of blood through a capillary. And the large veins have to be lowest in pressure so that blood gets drawn back to the heart. Okay. All right, so blood pressure, what is this controlled by? Well, it's controlled a lot by your heart, And we can look at the heart by understanding its heart rate, that's the chronotropy. We can look at the stroke volume, that's inotropy, right? That's the strength of contraction. And then something else, the peripheral resistance, the resistance to blood flow in blood vessels. And here is an equation that you should just memorize, right? Blood pressure is equal to stroke volume times heart rate times total peripheral resistance. Because we're very interested in helping patients maintain their blood pressure when it starts to drop or when something happens to their heart. All right, so what can you tell me about the relationship between blood pressure and stroke volume? Directly related. One goes up, the other goes up. What about heart rate? If heart rate goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It increases because it's directly related. What about resistance? If resistance increases, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. It's directly related. So if any of these goes up, blood pressure goes up. What's a really easy way that you can think of to increase the resistance in a blood vessel?
Exercise.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm thinking about a quality of a blood vessel, not really just a behavior that we do, but some parameter of that blood vessel. What can you increase or decrease? What parameter can you increase or decrease to change the resistance in a blood vessel? Viscosity, we can, right? But we don't usually do that. Let's look at, here's Poiseuille's law. We can't change viscosity. We can't change the length of a blood vessel, right? Unless we grow as tall as a skyscraper all of a sudden and go back to our normal height. We don't do that, right? But what can we change? The diameter or radius of a blood vessel, right? So if we increase the radius, right, then the resistance is going to decrease. So let's go to here. All right, so if we increase resistance, right, then blood pressure increases because they're directly related. Well, when I look at that equation, it is completely not intuitive to me at all why it's written that way. All right, but there are a couple of equations that are very intuitive to me, so let's derive. How about if we derive this equation right here? Hopefully, then you'll have an easier time remembering what it is, and you can use it to answer some questions. Right, because all these things are blood pressure is directly related to these things. Right, are you ready for that? I think you're ready. I think you're looking forward to it. What happened to that light? It blew up. Okay, there we go. Okay, so we're going to look at this equation right here. And here I see... You already worked on it. Here we have blood flow through the heart. What's blood flow through the heart equal to? Cardiac output. Cardiac output is equal to stroke volume, the force of contraction, times the heart rate. And here we have blood flow through a blood vessel. You know that to be the pressure divided by the resistance. If resistance increases, the blood flow goes down. So what do we have here? We've got blood flow. Blood flow through the heart, like we said just a little while ago, has to equal blood flow through the blood vessel. Otherwise, blood is going to back up someplace. It's going to pool someplace. All right, so what do we got? Oh, look, I got a little board right here. All right, so here we have the heart. Here we have a blood vessel. All right, and we've got blood flow through the heart is equal to what? Same thing as what? Cardiac output is equal to heart rate times stroke volume, or stroke volume times heart rate. All right, what about blood flow through this blood vessel right here? Blood flow is equal to pressure divided by resistance. Okay, so this is blood flow, right? Blood flow of the blood vessel, blood flow of the heart. We said these things have to be equal to each other. All right, so let's set them equal to each other. So we got what? We got heart rate times stroke volume is equal to pressure divided by resistance. Do you see how easy that is? That's not really hard. But we want to look at, right, so, and I'll put blood pressure right here, blood pressure. We want to look at these terms, right, in terms of blood pressure. So how would we get rid of this resistance on the right-hand side of the equation? Multiply both sides by R. We got R right here. These R's cancel out, and what are we left with? Resistance times heart rate, oh, I was a little sloppy, right? Heart rate times stroke volume is equal to pressure. And this resistance, if we add up all the resistance in blood vessels, that is what? Total peripheral resistance. So peripheral resistance times heart rate times stroke volume equals the pressure. So you could derive that during a test if you had to, right? Just by making these two things equal. All right, so it still might not be really intuitive why if you increase resistance, pressure goes up. But if you think about those equations, maybe it will make a little bit more sense. Okay? All right, so try to remember that one. So derive blood pressure equals stroke volume times heart rate times total peripheral resistance, knowing what blood flow is through the heart and knowing what blood flow is through a blood vessel. They have to be equal to each other. All right, so an increase in resistance. What happens to blood pressure if there's an increase in resistance? It goes up because it's directly related. Okay? So if you see that, who's got a question about that? No? Okay. You can Google in YouTube. No, not Google. You could search in YouTube for my name, and I did that in YouTube if you want to see that again. Okay? Okay, and it's probably under blood pressure, cardiac output, peripheral resistance are some of the key terms for that. Okay, so sympathetic adrenal activity. So that's activation of your sympathetic nervous system. What nervous system is that? Fight and flight or rest and digest? Sympathetic nervous system. Yeah, fight and flight, right? So that activity increases blood pressure via vasoconstriction. That's one way. So if there's constriction of a blood vessel, what happens to resistance? If there's constriction, if the radius decreases, yeah, the resistance increases in a big way. Okay, so what happens to blood pressure then if we increase resistance? What happens to pressure? It increases, right, because they're directly related to each other. So that's really handy. What about if there's increased cardiac output? How do you increase cardiac output? By increasing heart rate or stroke volume, or both. If you increase both of those, what happens to blood pressure? That increases because HR and SV are directly related to each other. Right? So that's kind of a mysterious statement, but if you look at that equation, it tells you nicely. Right, the kidney plays a role in maintaining blood pressure by regulating blood volume and thus stroke volume. So if stroke volume increases, what happens to pressure? Increases. So how is it that when your blood volume increases, the stroke volume increases? This is really good if you can make that connection. Right? If blood volume increases, why does blood pressure increase? One way you can memorize it, I suppose, is your car tire. If you want to increase the pressure in your tire, do you put air in or do you take air out? Yeah, you put air in. Right? You put volume into your blood, blood pressure goes up. That's maybe one way that you could think about it that will lead you to the right answer. But there's a better way of thinking about it, and that is when you increase blood volume, more blood goes back to the heart. The ventricles fill a little bit more. That stretches the ventricle. And if it's a normal heart, what happens to the heart when it starts to stretch? Okay, it gets larger. As the ventricle gets larger, what happens to its physiology? What about the force of contraction of the ventricle when it starts to fill up with more blood? Okay, it goes up, remember, and you got to know what the name of that process is. It's called the Frank Starling Law of the Heart, right? And that just says, as the ventricle gets bigger, as it fills up with more blood, the end diastolic volume increases, the contractility of the heart increases. Right, the heart gets stronger when more blood flows back to it. So that's going to increase the stroke volume. And of course, when you increase stroke volume, you know what happens to pressure because it's directly related. All right, so that Frank Starling law, we went over that, those properties really important because you can treat somebody in heart failure very quickly by giving them either diuretics or volume in their blood depending on what's causing their heart to fail. Okay, because there's both an ascending and a descending limb. Okay, what is the most important long-term mechanism for regulating blood pressure in your body? Yeah, and so you got to, when you think long term, you're going to think of some kind of hormonal system, not a nervous system. That is what the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And you have a really good slide in PowerPoint to look at that and ways to manipulate it with various kinds of inhibitors. Okay, so that's long term. The way that your body regulates blood pressure in the short term, like when you're sitting down right now and you stand up, your blood pressure is going to drop and not enough blood will go to your head. You will pass out if this mechanism isn't working. And that's really bad if you pass out when you stand up, because your head's going to bounce off the table and then the chair and then off the floor, and it sounds really bad. And I'm sure it feels really bad if you know when you wake up. So what regulates blood pressure in the short term is not a hormonal system, it's a nerve reflex, and it's called the baroreceptor reflex. So what is a barometer? Anybody know what a barometer is? It's a meter, right? Barometer, it's a meter that measures pressure, right? So if we have a barometer in the room, it's going to measure air pressure. And maybe somebody could tell me, what's the pressure in the room right now if you had a barometer? Is it high or low? It's low. We know it's low because it's raining like crazy outside, right? And low pressure systems bring a lot of rain. So we would know that there's low pressure right now compared to earlier this week or over the weekend. All right. Well, your body should monitor blood pressure in you because that's the driving force for blood through your circulatory system. And we have barometers. Right, they're called baroreceptors. So a baroreceptor is a receptor that can measure pressure in a blood vessel. And what it is that it's a stretch receptor in a blood vessel. So when a blood vessel stretches out, that increases the firing of action potentials to the cardioregulatory center. Right, so when does the aorta stretch? When it's experiencing high pressure or low pressure? Or doesn't it change if the pressure changes? Yeah, as the pressure increases, the aorta stretches more. It gets larger. And that activates these stretch receptors, which are then really baroreceptors. Okay. They send signals to the vasomotor center, cardioregulatory center in the medulla. They're most sensitive to a sudden decrease in blood pressure. Let's take a look. Okay, so here we have a heart. All right, and here I have sympathetic chain. What kind of information do you know goes through the sympathetic chain, ganglia? What kind of information? How about sympathetic outflow? Right, what nervous system is that? Fight or flight, fight and flight, or rest and digest? Yeah, that would increase your heart activity, right? So here is sympathetic cardiac nerve. Right. But that's only one division of the autonomic nervous system. What's the other division? Yeah. Well, you got sympathetic, and what's the other division? Parasympathetic, right? What's the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic? They are antagonistic to each other, right? And because they're antagonistic to each other, you have precise control of heart rate. All right. Well, how are these things used? Well, here are where the baroreceptors are located. They're located in the aortic arch and also the carotid sinus. A lot of times in anatomy, we do a really lousy job of describing where the carotid sinus is, but that's a hugely important vascular area because it's just loaded with disease processes. It fails in a lot of people, right? And when that fails, it can generate blood clots that can go to the internal carotid, and if you have a blood clot in the internal carotid artery, where does it go? Where does it end up? Internal carotid. Can you remember your anatomy? Internal carotid takes blood to the brain. Yeah, internal to the inside the cranium. And when you have a blood clot inside your brain, what do we call that? It's what nobody wants. Yeah, it's a stroke, right? That's a stroke when you have a blood clot in your brain. All right, so we're very interested in this area right here. But another reason why we're interested in this class is because there are baroreceptors in the carotid sinus. Right, and so these are receptors for blood pressure, right? And then they send information to the central nervous system. How does that blood pressure information get into the central nervous system? I think you learned this on the first day of class. Right, you got a stimulus, which is a decrease in blood pressure. You got a receptor, baroreceptors. that gives information to the afferent nerves, right? Sensory nerves, which takes it into the central nervous system, right? And what is in the central nervous system? Yeah, you got the integration center with a set point. That integration center knows what your blood pressure should be. It subtracts those two signals together to see if you're high blood pressure or low blood pressure. We're talking low blood pressure right at the moment. Then it makes a decision on what to do. All right, so I tell you what. Blood pressure starts to drop. Sends that information to the cardioregulatory center in the medulla. What would the answer be from the integration center if your blood pressure started to decrease? What would it want to do? Would it want to have it decrease more or increase back to normal? Increase back to normal. That would maintain homeostasis, right? So there the response would subtract from the stimulus. That would be a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so how would you increase? All right, blood pressure, as your blood pressure is dropping, cardioregulatory center is going to send information out through the parasympathetic nervous system. You know the cranial nerve that does that. What's the name of the cranial nerve? The vagus nerve, cranial nerve number 10. All right, and that's going to slow the heart rate down. But will that help your blood pressure if you slow heart rate down? If you decrease heart rate, what happens to blood pressure? It decreases. So the cardioregulatory center is going to stop sending signals through the parasympathetic nervous system because it doesn't want to slow your heart down. Instead, it's going to do what? Send signals through the sympathetic nervous system. Okay? And because it's antagonistic, you could probably guess what's going to happen. Right? These sympathetic nerves go to the atrium, which increase heart rate. If heart rate increases, what happens to blood pressure? Increases. Right? That's an important feature of the baroreceptor reflex. Sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricle, increases force of contraction. What's one way of thinking of a force of contraction? What's one way we could measure that? Is stroke volume, how much blood is pumped by the heart every time it beats. As the heart gets stronger, it pumps more blood every time it beats. What do we call that? The amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats. That is the stroke volume. Okay, so we increase heart rate, increase stroke volume. What's the result on blood pressure? Increase heart rate, increase stroke volume, blood pressure increases. Right? So heart rate is what? Chronotropy of the heart. Stroke volume is inotropy, force of contraction of the heart. Right? And so that's a reason why that equation is really handy. Something is missing from this slide. Maybe you should draw it in. You should draw in a blood vessel. Right? And when your blood pressure is dropping, what do you think should happen to that blood vessel? Sympathetic nervous system can adjust something in that blood vessel. Yeah. It can vasoconstrict or vasodilate it. In this particular case, if blood pressure is dropping, what would it want to do? Vasoconstrict or vasodilate? Okay? It wants to increase resistance by vasoconstriction, so those blood vessels will vasoconstrict, so total peripheral resistance will increase. That will also increase blood pressure. So the baroreceptor reflex works on these three parameters right here, the resistance, the heart rate, and stroke volume to maintain blood pressure so that when you stand up, you don't pass out. All right, so that's what we call, what do we call that reflex once again? The baroreceptor reflex, and why is, and for what reason is it important? What does it maintain? Blood pressure in what way? Long term or short term? Short term, because it's a nervous system, right? And long term is the hormonal one, right? The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Right? Two important ways that we maintain blood pressure. Okay, so that's the baroreceptor reflex. Here is that nice flow diagram that's in your book. Right, going from a lying down to standing position. Right, blood is going to pool in veins. Right, not enough blood returns to the heart. The end-diastolic volume goes down. If end-diastolic volume goes down, if the heart doesn't stretch, according to the Frank-Starling law, what happens to the force of contraction of the heart? It goes, look at this, as the end-diastolic volume goes down, less blood is presented to the heart gets weaker. So the stroke volume goes down. If stroke volume goes down, what can you tell me about cardiac output? Stroke volume goes down. Cardiac output goes down because they're directly related to each other. And if cardiac output goes down, what happens to pressure? Right, here's cardiac output. Heart rate times stroke volume directly related to blood pressure. Blood pressure is going to drop. So this is what we call the stimulus. All right, so a stimulus is a decrease in blood pressure. All right, for this mechanism right here. But we're lucky because what do we have that can measure that decrease in blood pressure? Yeah, we got baroreceptors, and you should know where they're located. Carotid sinus, aortic arch. And so we got the receptors, right? We got the stimulus, we got receptors, and then what? We got afferent neurons bringing it to the cardioregulatory center or integration center in the medulla. Compare the blood pressure to the set point, then this integration center can make up its mind what to do. So the stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. What would the choice for the medulla to make? Increase sympathetic activity and reduce parasympathetic activity. So what does that do? Well, increasing sympathetic activity causes vasoconstriction of arterioles that raises total peripheral resistance. What happens to blood pressure? It increases. Okay. What about the heart? So here we have the other leg. Increases heart rate. Right? So that increases cardiac output. But sympathetic activity is also going to increase force of contraction, which is stroke volume. So both heart rate and stroke volume will increase, and those are the items that go into cardiac output. So cardiac output goes up, right? Stroke volume and heart rate goes up, blood pressure is going to go up as well. All right, so you can memorize, I think this is an exam figure, okay? And so that will raise blood pressure. How? And that's the response, an increase in blood pressure. What was the initial stimulus? A decrease in blood pressure, right? So how does that relate to the, how does the response relate to the stimulus? Does it add or subtract? Yeah, so what kind of feedback loop is that? Yeah, and is that a good thing? Is a negative feedback loop a good thing or something that's going to drive you into disease? It's good. It maintains homeostasis, right? It maintains blood pressure not at a constant level, but increases and decreases around set point, which is suitable to support life. All right, so what's the most important short-term regulation of blood pressure? Baroreceptor, because it's a nerve reflex. And the endocrine reflex, right, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism is for long-term regulation of blood pressure. Because the endocrine system takes longer to work, but it has more longer lasting effects. All right, so that's it for this chapter. This is probably the most fun chapter. So now we only got to talk about some things that are not quite so fun. But maybe you like these other things too. Maybe you like respiratory physiology, reproductive physiology. Okay, so let's talk about respiratory physiology. Get started with that. Chapter 16. All right, so what is respiration? We look at a lot of respiration. Cellular respiration is a way that our body can extract energy from fuel molecules. Right? Our body can break down big, large biomolecules into smaller ones. We call that catabolism. Catabolism is exothermic, and that energy can be used to make ATP. Right? That's a way of thinking about respiration. Right, so oxygen utilization. So when we think of all those biochemical pathways, that's what we think about in terms of internal respiration, all those biochemical pathways. But we also want to think about, oh, I got to get my arrow back. Great. External respiration. External respiration is just the process of moving air inside and out of our lungs, in and out of our lungs, right? So that's another way to think about respiration. And then, so oxygen enters the blood in our lungs, and then oxygen is going to leave the blood through capillaries in our tissues. We also have to think about how oxygen leaves the blood to get into our tissues. That's another important part of respiration. So we got external and internal respiration. All right, here's a little quick review of some anatomy of the lung. So here we have a lung, Here we got a nice trachea. This is just a windpipe, just one single tube coming from our larynx right down into our thoracic cavity, and then it bifurcates into a bronchus. That's the first bifurcation, and that first bifurcation, that becomes the primary bronchus, and then after it bifurcates again, here's a secondary bronchus, and then after it bifurcates again, here's a tertiary bronchus, and then these bronchi get smaller and smaller and smaller until they actually get into something called a bronchiole. So here's a bronchiole. You might notice a big difference between a bronchiole and a bronchus or a trachea. What difference do you notice right here? Between this tube and this tube here, just besides their size. Size is hugely different, but there's another thing that should be different. Trachea has cartilage. Bronchi have cartilage. Bronchioles do not have cartilage. Now, does anybody know why the trachea has cartilage and all these bronchi have cartilage? What do they do? What does that cartilage do? It holds these air passageways open. They're open all the time. Your trachea is open all the time because the cartilage is holding them open. And that's really important because that airway has to stay open whether you're inhaling or exhaling. It doesn't matter. One way that we exhale is that we compress our thoracic cavity to force air out, like that. We compress our thoracic cavity, that would have a tendency to collapse the trachea. It would collapse. And when you change the radius of that trachea, what happens to flow? If you constrict that trachea, what happens to flow? It goes way down in a big hurry, right? So in that process, right, by constricting the trachea, we couldn't exhale. But it's held open all the time, so we can exhale. So why is exhaling so important? Because if you don't exhale, you can't get new air in the lung, right? So before you can inhale, you got to exhale. If the trachea is occluded, you can't exhale, so no other air can enter the lung. All right, so that's why these structures have cartilage in them compared to maybe another tube that we see in this area, which is the esophagus. The esophagus doesn't have cartilage. Well, what's one problem? What's one problem clinically, since this trachea is open all the time, what does that produce sometimes? Why is that a problem? Here we have a tube that's open all the time. It's just sitting there, waiting for something to happen. Right? If you're goofing around, right, and you have something in your mouth, and you swallow it at the same time you try to take a breath, where is that food going to go? It's going to go into the larynx, and then it's going to fall right into the trachea, right, because the trachea is open all the time. All you got to do is put something over the top of it, it's going to fall right in. And then it's going to constrict the trachea. You can't breathe. What do we call that when you can't breathe? And you should know what it, yeah. And what's the sign? Because when you can't breathe, you can't talk, but you want to tell somebody that you can't breathe, how do you signal to somebody that you are choking? This is a universal sign. And I'm really glad you're going to learn this because you might choke one of these days and you're going to ask for help. How do you ask for help when you're choking? Okay, not quite like that, but like this. Yeah, that's a universal sign for choking. And I'm sure many of you guys are educated. What can you do for somebody that's choking? You can try to open up their airway by doing a Heimlich maneuver, right? That's a part of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, right? And that forces that object out of the trachea so that somebody can breathe. Well, why are we breathing? Because we need oxygen, right? Going past these bronchioles, and then finally, right, into these alveolar ducts, and then into an alveolus. So here is a pocket. An alveolus is just a pocket. Remember, the root of a tooth fits into an alveolus. That's a pocket in our mandible or maxilla. And so air enters these little pockets, and surrounding these pockets are capillaries. So what happens around all of these alveoli? What takes place if they're surrounded by a capillary? There's gas exchange, right? Oxygen inside the alveolus goes into the capillary, right? And then there's carbon dioxide that's in the capillary. It can go into the alveolus, and then you exhale, you get carbon dioxide out of your body. Okay. We have about 300 million of these alveoli. Well, I guess this is a good place. So here's an alveolus, greatly enhanced. Okay, we have 300 million of them, and how would we want to think about this area for exchange? Okay, I'm sure I measured something in here. Did I ever describe to you what a surface area is? Oh, wow, I can't remember. Did I ever take this ruler right here and talk about a surface area? What is surface area? It's the length of something times the width, right? So surface area has two dimensions. So we could measure the dimension of this tabletop, right? But there's probably something a little bit more interesting to measure the surface area of, and that is, what is this thing here? Doorway. Okay? How would we measure the surface area of this doorway? I tell you what, is it bigger or less than that tabletop? This doorway, bigger surface area or less? It's bigger, right? But let's measure the surface area. Here I have a meter stick. And we can measure the surface area by measuring the width multiplied by the height. That's the surface area. So what's the width of this door? It's 1 meter. So that's really nice and handy, right? Because we're going to multiply that number by the height, and multiplying by one is like the easiest thing you can do in life, right? All right, but we got to measure the height. So what's the height of this door? Well, it's more than 1 meter, because here's 1 meter right here, right? And then here is 2 meters, and we're fortunate again because, look, it's exactly 2 meters. Isn't that nice? So what's the surface area of this door? Exactly 2 square meters. All right. So when you think of surface area, I want you to think of it as what? A doorway for exchange, when we say surface area. All right, so we're going to calculate what the surface area is for all of these alveoli. If we take them, flatten them all out, put them on the table, how big does that table have to be to take all 300 million of them, flatten them out so that they're just a flat plane like that? All right, so here is your answer. It is 60 to 80 square meters, and probably you could say either one of these numbers right here, but what is that equal to, right? That many square meters. That's equal to the surface area of a two-level house, the floor surface of two levels of a general kind of house that we find in our neighborhoods. So is that a huge surface area? Oh, I lied. That's the wrong run. It's half of a tennis court. I'm sorry, half of a tennis court. Not quite as impressive, but still, that's pretty tall and pretty wide, right? Half of a tennis court is 80 square meters. And so you might be wondering, well, how do you get this big, huge surface area into a small space? Because personally, I wouldn't like to be as wide as a tennis court and tall as half of a tennis court, right? Because that would be huge. You couldn't find clothes. So how do we get that big surface area and get it stuck in our thoracic cavity? Generally, how does your body do that? And you do this around the house, right? You fold things up. And that's what all these alveoli are. They're basically just folds so that this big, huge surface area, right, half of a tennis court, can fit inside our thoracic cavity. And if you look at a filter that you have in the house, is it just a flat piece of paper? Maybe for your furnace. It's what? It's all folded up. It has all these folds, which means it's what? It's a really big, large filter that air can flow through. Take a look at an air filter sometime. Or, yeah, you can look at an oil filter, but then that would be messy, right? So look at an air filter. So that folding increases the surface area. Here is that alveolus. And I see the wall of the alveolus here. All right, then I see a little interstitial space, and here is the wall of a capillary. I see some nice red blood cells in there. I guess that's okay. Usually there's only room for one red blood cell at a time through a capillary, but this is okay. So what are the areas that blood has, that oxygen and carbon dioxide have to diffuse across? It has to diffuse across the wall of the alveolus, the small interstitial space, and the wall of this capillary. And so what do we call something that lines a cavity? What kind of tissue is that? That is an epithelium, right? Lines a cavity, covers a surface, or lines a cavity, that's an epithelium. All right, so here is an epithelium lining this cavity of a capillary. And what kind of epithelium do we see right here? How do you characterize an epithelium? There are two ways. By what and by what? Characterize an epithelium. Wow, I hope you didn't throw your anatomy books away. Okay, it's by what? The number of layers and the shape of the cells. So how many layers do we see in the wall of this capillary? Many or one? That's your choices, right? Simple or stratified. So what do we have here? Nice, simple. And what are the shape of this, what's the shape of this cell right here? Is it, what are the choices? Squamous, cuboidal, or columnar? Is it columnar? No way. Is it cuboidal? No. We have last choices. Squamous, it's flat, right? So here's a simple squamous epithelium, and a simple squamous epithelium is a specialized structure for what kind of function? Exchange, right? Because it's thin. Things can diffuse across a simple squamous epithelium. All right, what about the epithelium that makes this alveolus? How would you characterize this epithelium? Same, right? It's simple squamous, right? So that's not columnar, not cuboidal, and so the structure of this alveolus is specialized for exchange, right? And so we have oxygen in the alveolus diffusing across this short space into the capillary. CO2 in this capillary can diffuse across that short distance into the alveolus, and then when we breathe in and out, that air is exchanged with our environment. Okay. So sometimes we call this the respiratory membrane. Respiratory membrane is the wall of the alveolus, interstitial space, and the wall of the capillary. That's what something has to diffuse across. Okay, well, I see some other cells. I see a nice red blood cell right here in this capillary, some white blood cells. Remember, these are shapeshifters. They can crawl around, they can crawl out of a capillary. And when this monocyte crawls out into the alveolus, it becomes a macrophage, right? And all these are like little pseudopods sticking out. It's a shapeshifter. It can crawl around in there looking for things that don't belong in your body. Like, what would it be looking for? What doesn't belong in your lungs? Bacteria, viruses, dust particles, fungi, stuff like that. All right, so this guy is part of your immune system. All right, and then the other things I noticed, the other cells in this alveolus, I see that the squamous cell, right, is called a type 1 alveolar cell. And then there is one that's in the wall of the alveolus that we call a type 2 alveolar cell. Why do we have these two types? Well, the type 1 makes the wall. This type 2 over here is really special because water can cause a problem inside this alveolus. And of course, do we have water inside our body? Absolutely. We've got a lot of water, right? So this alveolus is going to be moist. There's water in there. What happens? Right? Is water slippery or is it sticky? Say there's some water on the floor. You step on it. What's going to happen? You might slip, right? So you might have an idea that water is slippery. But I want you to understand a very nice physical property of water, and that is water really is sticky. How are we going to see that? Well, you might remember or have seen sometime that there are actually some animals that can walk right on the surface of water. Has anybody ever seen an animal walk on water? Yeah, like what kind of animal? Like a water spider? Yeah. Some lizards, if they run really fast, because they're not heavy enough to actually go kaplunk. And these water spiders can actually just stand on water. They don't even have to move, right? They can just walk on water. All right, and why is that? Because the water molecules like to stick together. Water is really sticky. We call that surface tension. Water has surface tension because water molecules like to stick together. So I think we should do a really quick experiment. Let's see if it works. Here I have two transparencies. Regular old transparencies. Anybody want to look to see their regular transparencies? They look good, okay. And I got two of them, right? And I'm going to kind of put them together like this, and I'm going to force them together, and they're offset, so I can grab one without grabbing the other. So right now I'm holding both, and then if I just hold on to one, what happens to the other one? There's no water in there, right? There's no water. So if I let go of one, it's just going to fall away, right? So let's glue these together. How can we glue these together? I don't have glue. But I think we have water right here. I didn't check. I got Coke. There's water in Coca-Cola. But here's some water. Yeah, good water. Let's put some water on here. Like so. You can do this at home with some plates or saucers or anything like that. Put some water between two plates that fit together really nicely, like these transparencies. So now I'm holding both of these transparencies, and I'm going to let go of one. What's going to happen to the other? Is it going to fall away? It's just going to stay right there because they're glued together. Now, how much force is that? Well, I want somebody to grab just the edge of that one transparency, and I'm going to hold the edge of the other one. So who wants to be my assistant? Who wants to grab the bottom of this one? Okay, just grab the bottom. Just hold it, and then I'm going to pull. And then you can tell me how much force. A little bit less, a little bit less. I think you're grabbing both of them a little bit down. Yeah, just like that. So now I'm going to pull. Oh, you got to grab a little bit tighter than that. Okay. Oh, two hands? Okay, use two hands. Was that a lot of force? Oh, you didn't even get it still. But we got it to move a little bit. Is that a lot of glue? Is that very sticky? What about water? Very sticky, right? All right. And because there is water in this alveolus, the walls of the alveolus would collapse, and what would happen to them? They would stick together. They couldn't inflate, right? And if they can't get larger and inflate, then, of course, air can't get in there. So that surface tension has to be reduced. And this alveolar type 2 cell is responsible for reducing surface tension because it releases a compound, right, to the wall of the alveolus that we call surfactant. Yeah, surfactant. Surface active agent that decreases the surface tension and allows this alveolus to inflate. So that is hugely important. And that's due to this alveolar type 2 cell. All right. Usually, when somebody's born, the process of being born is very stressful, and that stimulates these alveolar type 2 cells to produce surfactant, which allows neonate to inflate their lungs. But if there is a fetus that is not full term, okay, which is being born prematurely, usually through cesarean section, they don't experience that kind of stress, plus these alveolar type 2 cells haven't matured in their lungs, guess what happens to their lung function, their pulmonary function? These cells aren't secreting surfactant. They have tremendous difficulty ventilating because these alveoli are stuck together. And what do we do for a premature newborn baby like that? Yeah, put them in an incubator, which is high in oxygen. So even though their lungs aren't functioning, there's a bigger concentration gradient for oxygen, and they can still get oxygen inside these capillaries right here because they're in that incubator. All right, there are some people that lose the function of these alveolar cells. That's a problem. Okay. All right, so here is that alveolus. Okay. This is all good. All right, what else do I want to say about this alveolus? I had something else I wanted to say. Oh, here it is. Your anatomy book does a really nice job. All right, so here's that alveolus, and you can see capillaries surrounding the alveolus, but there's something else that surrounds this alveolus that's not shown on this diagram. And I didn't copy the picture from the anatomy book. Maybe I'll show it to you quickly next time. There's another network besides the network of capillaries. Anybody remember what that other network is? It's a network of proteins, but it's a special kind of protein fiber. How many kinds of fibers did you learn about in anatomy? I think there were basically three. You had a strong one, which was called collagen. You had a really weak one that's not really strong at all, rips apart all the time, that is. Reticular. Okay, reticular rips apart all the time. And then the third one somebody just told me, which is in between the strength of collagen and reticular. And that one's really fancy. It's a fiber that you can stretch without damage to some degree. And when you let go of that stretch, what happens? It goes back. That's an elastic fiber. So there's a network of elastic fibers that surround this alveolus so that when you inhale and inflate the alveolus, right, to get air out, all you have to do is relax muscles. And when you relax muscles, those elastic fibers pull the alveolus smaller, and that forces air out of the lungs. Okay, so for the kind of breathing we're doing right now, which is called quiet breathing, it takes a muscle to inhale, and that's called the diaphragm. We inhale using the diaphragm, but to exhale for quiet breathing, all we have to do is relax, that elastic tissue takes over and forces air out of our lungs. So inspiration is active, requires muscles, but expiration is, tell me what the word is, passive, right? As long as you have all those nice elastic fibers remaining around the alveolus. So I could see if you guys were listening to lecture. I've got a couple alveoli right here. There's a couple sacs. Here's a paper bag. All right, then I don't know, maybe I picked this up right before Thanksgiving on the way home. I'm not sure. I forgot when I actually got it. All right. And then I have a balloon. All right, so these are two chambers. I want you to tell me which one is a better model of an alveolus. Okay? So let's inflate the paper bag. Or I'll do it. Nice. All right, so I've inflated this alveolus. I've trapped all the air in there, right, because I've reduced the diameter of that windpipe right there, so no air can flow out. And now let me dilate that pipe right through there so that air can flow out. Will air flow out of this bag? Okay, I'll make the diameter even bigger. Is air flowing out? It's not, okay? Here is another example of an alveolus. Here is a balloon. And let's inflate the balloon and see what happens, okay? I hope it doesn't rip. Oh, good, it didn't break. Oh, dang, sometimes it does, rats. Okay, who's got a balloon? Nobody, I got a backup, but this one I think is even older. Can I even unfold it? Oh, without ripping it, I don't know. Okay, here's a balloon. Let's see if I won't inflate it quite so much. Okay, maybe I'll exercise it. Exercise is good, right? Diet and exercise. Okay, I don't know what kind of diet it's had, but here's some exercise. Okay, good idea. I think that's working. Okay, inflate. I can't inflate. Oh, rats. Might have to do this next time. There's no way. This is the only balloon I have left. Okay. I can't pull it apart. I can't even, like, rub it. Maybe if I rub it together. Yeah. If I just kind of twirl it. Okay. So this is a good example of why your trachea has cartilage, right? To make sure that little tube stays open. Okay, maybe I've opened it enough. Yeah, I think there's a hole in the side too. Okay, I can't do it. All right, well, we can continue the thought experiment. Say this is a balloon all filled up with air. Okay, and then I let go of the top. What's going to happen to the air inside this balloon? And it's going to come rushing out because the balloon is elastic. Right, so when I let go of the balloon, it's just going to fly up in the air like that. So what's a better model of an alveolus? This balloon, this properly working balloon in your mind, or a plastic bag? The balloon, right? Because it has those elastic properties. So a really healthy alveolus will deflate all by itself. That's why quiet breathing expiration is passive. Okay. You have to love live demonstrations. I checked that balloon out before class, but I didn't inflate it quite so much, I guess. All right, so don't forget about those elastic properties around an alveolus. And how many you have, conducting zone, thoracic cavity, you know, all this kind of stuff. Okay, I want to talk about this figure a little bit. I see some lungs right there. What kind of section is this as I turn some lights on? Again? Wow. I got some stuff over here which you can't see. Okay, yeah, it's a nice transverse section, right? We see a nice transverse section. Here is a lung, and there's a membrane around the lung, and you should be able to tell me what kind of membrane it is. You should be aware of how many major kinds of membranes are there? The major kinds? You got two? You've got mucous membrane that lines a cavity that's open to the outside world, like nasal cavity, oral cavity, reproductive tract, urinary tract. There's a mucous membrane. But the lungs are in a cavity not open to the outside world, so it has not a mucous membrane, but a serous membrane around it, right? And a serous membrane has three parts. There is a part of the membrane that's right on the surface of the lung. So here's the surface of the lung, and that's what we call the visceral serous membrane. And since this is around the lung, we call it the pleural membrane. So visceral pleural membrane is right on the surface of the lung. And if we follow it around, we see that it is continuous, right, with the membrane that actually ends up on the wall of the thorax. Right? It's continuous, but since it's in a different location, we give it a different name. We call that the parietal division of that serous membrane. So visceral division is on the visceral organ. The parietal is on the wall of that cavity. And, of course, there is a space between these two membranes that we call the serous space. And in this particular case, we're going to call this the pleural space. Right? Pleural space. Okay. And so the way that we get air in and out of our lungs is that we change the shape of the thorax and we increase the volume. That then pulls on the lungs, increases the volume inside the lungs. Right, so in this particular case, we would want the visceral membrane to stick to the parietal membrane right here. We don't want them to come apart so that when we expand our rib cage, we don't want this pleural space to get bigger. We want the wall of the thorax to actually pull on the surface of the lung to make it bigger. What can we use to glue the visceral membrane to the parietal membrane here? What's a really good glue? Water. Yeah. And it's easy to find water in our body. So in this space right here, would we want to secrete surfactant into this space? In this particular case, no. Right? We use the stickiness of water to glue these two divisions of that serous membrane together so that we can inflate our lungs. All right, so what do I want to show you here? I wrote down some things, right, on the board, so maybe I can mute. Can I mute? Auto image one. Video mute one. Ah, okay. Here I wrote down some definitions, which I think your book does kind of a lousy way of talking about it, because sometimes they use different terms to mean the same thing. All right, so here is my really fancy diagram. I don't have this one on YouTube because it's just too fancy. All right, so what do we have? We have the wall of the thorax right here. And what's inside the thorax? We have the lungs. Right? And I see a couple spaces. I see a space inside the lung, and we're going to call that the intrapulmonary space. And there's an air pressure in there. We're going to call that the intrapulmonary pressure. Intrapulmonary, intrapulmonary is inside the lung. Right. And then here we have a space, the intrapleural space. Intrapleural space is just that space between the serous and visceral membrane. Intrapleural. Right. And your book, for some reason, calls intrapulmonary, transpulmonary. Oh, okay. Well, sometimes we want to look at the difference in these two pressures to understand which way the lung is going to go. That's called the transpulmonary pressure. All right, so it's the difference in these two pressures is transpulmonary. Your book also calls it the transmural pressure. Transmural and transpulmonary is the same. Transmural is just the pressure across the wall right there. So transmural pressure is intrapulmonary minus intrapleural pressure. So when I talk about some of these different pressures, kind of have to have a picture in your mind of where these pressures are. All right, so intrapulmonary is the pressure inside an alveolus, or the intraalveolar pressure. Intrapleural pressure is where? Pressure in the pleural space, which is what you see on that diagram right there. I don't have that in Blackboard, but I suppose I could put something like that in Blackboard, but you can probably copy it down fast. And then I'll turn the projector back on for a second. Let me see what the next slide looks like. I think there's maybe just one last thing that I can talk about before we break for the day. All right, so I'm going to talk about these. Look this over before Thursday. The last thing that I'm going to talk about is something we call Boyle's Law. And here's Boyle's Law. I see pressure. P stands for pressure. V stands for volume. How is volume and pressure, or how are they related to each other according to Boyle's Law? How is pressure and volume related to each other in Boyle's Law? Directly related or inversely related? Inversely related. Right? So if the volume increases, what happens to pressure? It decreases. If volume decreases, what happens to pressure? Increases, right? Because there's an inverse relationship. And so this is how we move air in and out of our body. Remember, fluid like air will move from high pressure to low pressure, right? We change the pressure inside our chest, and we do that by changing the volume. Right, so if we want to decrease the pressure below atmospheric pressure, so if the pressure inside our chest is lower than atmospheric pressure, which way will air move? If our lungs is low compared to the air. Air is going to flow in, right, because it's high pressure in the air. Right, so that means that we have to increase volume of the chest to do that. So how do we increase the volume of our chest? Here is a pretty good example, right, of somebody's respiratory apparatus. The balloons are somebody's lungs. Here's somebody's trachea. That's an air passageway. What does this black thing represent? The diaphragm, right, separation between abdominal and thoracic cavity. And then the wall of the thorax is just this glass bell. That we can't change. But we can change the volume inside this glass by manipulating the diaphragm. So if I push the diaphragm in, that decreases the volume inside, right? If I push the diaphragm in, that decreases the volume. So if we decrease the volume, what happens to pressure inside there? Pressure increases when we decrease the volume, because that's Boyle's Law, inversely related. So when I decrease the volume, what happens to the balloons? Did they inflate, deflate, or didn't change? They deflated. I don't know if you can see that back there. Right? But now let's increase the volume by pulling the diaphragm down. That's going to increase the volume. Right? So if we increase volume, what happens to pressure? Okay. So if we increase the volume, that decreases the pressure. And what happened to the lungs? The balloons in this particular... Oh, guess what we found? Some balloons. Okay, the balloons inflated. Right? And when the diaphragm relaxes, the balloons deflate. When the diaphragm contracts, okay, it goes like that, and the balloons inflate. So your lungs work the exact same way due to pressure volume changes inside our thoracic cavity. All right, I didn't want to bring this down next time. All right, so just remember this little experiment we did, and we're going to talk about ventilation a little bit next time. So sign-in sheet is going around.